Hello, welcome to the first recorded Waldman's Words of 2018, but I believe the third one to air. So I hope you guys enjoyed the Kyle Hewlett episode last week. Resident Adobe sad boy. I hate that phrase, but seems to be pretty commonplace when describing Kyle. So today we have someone who I've known since his infancy, actually. He's a close family friend, Jesse Grushak, and he's definitely making some waves in the tech space. And we haven't had anyone from that arena on our show, so I'm excited to hear and learn about Ujo Music, about blockchain, and he might even impart some Bitcoin knowledge upon all y'all. And speaking of Bitcoin, we have another one next week. Her name is Kristen Schlosser, and she, like me, is A&R at Legend Recordings, which is a new gig for me, and hopefully soon I'll announce the band I signed, so I'm really excited about that. The following week, I've got Maggie Kunin from Hopeless Records, and this will be the second Hopeless Records guest on the show. We've had Megan Thompson on the air, so that was pretty sweet. And then the following week, we've got Tom Mullen, who works in, I guess, many different facets of the industry. Currently, he's at Atlantic, but he just published a book on emo, and I love talking about that stuff. I think that the 90s era, I guess the mid-90s rock music era, is often underrated. And then we've got a booking agent slash musician named Imran Excelili. And if I butchered your name, Imran, I apologize, but we've never actually spoken. So this year is already booked until, I think, August, which is kind of crazy because someone hit me up about being on the show, and I'm like, if there's a cancellation, I'll let you know. But thank you, as always, especially Emily Burke, but everyone else in the audience listening every single Tuesday night at 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, and the show reruns every single Sunday morning at 5 a.m. Pacific time and 8 a.m. Eastern time. So I'm excited to have Jesse Grushak on the show for many, many reasons, and I hope you guys learn a little something about where the industry is going, because the past few years have been, I guess, the year of the Spotify playlist. I remember when songs on people's MySpace profiles were big, and CDs, cassettes. I guess in my lifetime I've witnessed a little bit, and actually the resurgence of vinyl. So you never know where the industry is going to go, but it's definitely moving fast. So stick around for Waldman's Words with Jesse Grushak. Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with a man I've known his entire life, Jesse Grushak.
How's it going, Scott? Glad to be here.
I'm really excited. We booked this a few months ago, shortly after I checked out your suave offices, and we'll get into that in a bit. But I guess growing up where we grew up, it was a pretty musical town. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, from an early age, I was involved in music. I started taking piano lessons probably around age 5 or 6, and grew up into playing trumpet and guitar at some point for a year or two. And now it seems once I left home, that kind of left with me. But kind of still fell back into music in college.
Let's actually go way, way back before we even get to college. So you grew up, would you say that you grew up in a pretty musical household?
Yeah, absolutely. My parents both have a love for music. My sister played saxophone, so it's definitely a musical household.
Your sister was actually the only friend of my sister's at my bar mitzvah, so shout out to Sydney Grushak for representing. I think you were too young to attend at the time. What year were you born?
92, so...
Yeah, mine was in March of 1994, so you were a little bit too little for that one. But so you grew up Just so the people are listening, in Long Beach, New York, and I mean, everyone, I guess, feels the need slash requirement to name drop Billy Crystal every time they talk about Long Beach, but it's kind of crazy. But a lot of people don't realize this. Producer Rick Rubin, who's worked with Beastie Boys, Slayer, Red Hot Chili Peppers, is from Long Beach, and it has quite a community for musicians. And so when you started, I guess, on piano and trumpet, did you do trumpet just in elementary school band, or were you doing any before that?
No, that was, it was, I guess, yeah, it was in, I guess, elementary school. Yeah, started taking trumpet lessons. Continued throughout until my junior year of high school.
And going on those badass band trips. I don't know if they had it when
No,
you
they
were.
stopped doing those band trips.
Ah,
But
bummer. Bummer,
then they kind of
bummer.
started sucking all the fun out of band and making everyone in our really, really awesome marching band.
Which kind of crazy is like that was the reason why everyone did it, but it was pretty fun. So you did that. Did you continue playing piano? I mean, I really wish that my parents pushed me to play piano when I was younger. The first instrument I really played was recorder, and you know how that goes. And then I played trombone, and I sucked. I really sucked. So when you were taking piano lessons, like how often did you do it?
That's a good question. It was probably once a week, from when I was like 6 until probably about 12, when I kind of switched over to trumpet and kind of left piano behind.
You didn't join any ska bands or anything?
No ska bands. Just high school band and middle school band. And actually, I was in jazz band in middle school and in high school.
Well, when you were thinking about going to college, did you have any foresight that you'd be working in music, or you just had no idea what the heck you were going to do?
No, absolutely not. Music, it was never one of those careers that seemed sustainable. As having Jewish parents, they're always be
Oh,
a
I have
doctor, be a
those.
lawyer.
I understand. Or become a
Right, so.
chiropractor. I heard a rumor that that's in your family a little bit.
Yeah, so doctor, lawyer, engineer at the very least, was
At the
always
very
something I was
least.
being.
At the least, if you had to settle for
You have
something.
to settle, you can be an engineer, but
Okay, that's funny.
so yeah, I went to school kind of starting in engineering, because I've always been interested in how things work and been pretty technically savvy, I guess, my whole life.
Technical.
Yep.
What school was this, and where was it?
So I went to Union College in Schenectady, New York.
Okay.
So that's right near Albany. Started as a undeclared engineering, switched to computer engineering, decided that I had no desire to design chips in my life. Kind of fell into computer science and ended up graduating with a computer science and economics degree.
Oh, wow. Multifaceted. A lot of people are looking for computer science degrees nowadays. I mean, would you say that you're pretty adept with coding?
There are definitely people that are better than I am. But I can look at it, I can understand it, and I think just my general approach to problem solving has really been enhanced from that degree.
Well, Albany, I know, has quite a vibrant college population. Is Schenectady like relatively close? Would you say that it was kind of similar to the vibe of like a Boston where the majority of people that you interacted with were college students? Was it like pretty big in that regard?
Yeah, it was, it was a 2400 person school, so it wasn't a big town, it wasn't a big school, but that was probably the biggest thing in that town, because General Electric actually was headquartered there, and then when they left, they kind of depressed that whole area.
I'm familiar with that with Michigan, with the auto industry, so with Flint and all that stuff. But so I guess walk me through, I guess what you were doing in college, and then let's get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, basically, kind of started going to electronic dance music shows in college, and around the same time, kind of found Bitcoin and thought it was pretty useless at first. You couldn't buy anything with it. I didn't understand any of the implications of it. I just saw it as a really, really worthless currency that no one was really using at the time. So those were kind of my two passions in school was music and eventually becoming Bitcoin and blockchain technology. But on the music side of things, I started, you know, I realized that dance music was powerful. You know, I went to a festival or two and started realizing that, you know, this was what was hot. This is what was cool. And I wanted to get involved in any way I could. I started writing for a music blog, posting music.
What blog was it?
It was dancingastronaut.com. And so, it was, you know, posting music, uploading music legally to RapidShare and all of that, and creating playlists and getting artist passes and photo passes so I could, you know, get backstage and try to get involved and do interesting things in music. And when it came time to get kind of internships in the summers, it was my two interests, music and blockchain. There was nothing in blockchain at all. So I guess in a way I settled for music.
You settled for it. Nice.
I settled for it, you know, and I kind of found a real passion in it. And so I started working with IDMT, which is I guess they're technically a concert promoter, based out of Amsterdam, and they produce events like Sensation, Tomorrowland, really big, electronic music festivals. And yeah, so after school, I kind of just, you know, rolled that into a job, and started working full time at SFX Entertainment, who had bought ID&T, at the intersection of technology and live events.
Okay. Was that in New York City? Did you go straight to the city right after college?
Yep. So it was based in New York City. Basically, the premise behind SFX was to go around and buy up all these concert promoters and, you know, festival companies all around the country, with the eventual goal of rolling them up and going public and selling it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the company was a little mismanaged. You know, there were some really heavy hitters from the rock and roll days kind of leading the company. But they had no grasp on electronic music and the culture and community it kind of fostered. So they were kind of just trying to, you know, jam together all these little companies with a giant corporate overlord, and it didn't work too well. They went bankrupt beginning of 2016, I believe.
Oh, wow. Well, speaking of what you used the word jam, and I was actually thinking of like the whole jam band circuit. Would you say that electronic festivals have a lot in common with that kind of mentality? Because it's honestly, this is a world I know nothing about.
Yeah, I absolutely would. You know, it's you know, these cultures, these communities, they're all very similar in the way they kind of bring people together. You know, there's something about going to, you know, Warped Tour and having one of the greatest days of your life, or going to an electronic music show and having the greatest day of your life, and just being around thousands of other people that share your interests. You know, it's something that I always found was pretty kind of empowering and a really cool feeling when you're kind of in the mix of it.
I agree. I mean, I guess when I was in 11th grade, I went to my first Warped Tour, and it was, I mean, I call it ADD theater because each band has a 30-minute set, and at the time, Warped Tour was like $20, and you could legitimately see 30 bands you like and with a lot of like-minded people, and at the time, it wasn't as mainstream as it became, but then shortly after, there was one year where it was Eminem was playing right before Blink-182, and that was like as big as it got.
Wow.
Yeah, and Eminem got booed, believe it or not. It was pretty nuts. It was like just before My Name Is was about to blow up, and he got booed by like the rock audience, who I guess didn't find it as cool. And nowadays, kids, I guess I wouldn't lump you in the kid category. I'd lump like younger people, like they're more open to being into rock, being into hip hop, being into EDM. Whereas when I was growing up, it was like a high school cafeteria. It's like the punk kids like punk, the metal kids like metal, the hip hop kids like hip hop. And now I guess, I don't know if it's because of streaming technology or maybe just because kids are becoming more open-minded, but do you understand what I'm saying? Like, do you agree?
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think, you know, that's electronic music was almost kind of the next step in that, really. It was like, just bringing people together. You could see, you know, like you said, 30 DJs, prices were a little bit higher than $20, but yeah, it was, you know, these communities. And I think a lot of the electronic music was a very open and kind of, you know, community that, you know, they always harp on the plur, the peace, love, unity kind of ethos. And yeah, I mean, you know, it was, I guess that was kind of the transition towards being more open about music. And because it got to the point where, you know, I guess you called it ADB theater, and I think that's an even more, you know, amplified through electronic music with all the lights and, you know, sound like smoke and lasers and everything. That
shiny objects. Kind of,
yeah, exactly. You know, they started to produce, and it gets a little old after a while, right? And so you need something, you need a live instrument, you need, you know, a collaboration or something to really, to make it interesting again.
Well, especially if it's someone with a turntable or a laptop. I mean, they're not, everyone's like Steve Aoki where they're running everywhere. Sometimes they're glued to that spot. So the other, if they have, I guess, like crazy screens in the background. And I mean, I've witnessed some electronic music live, but I've never been to an entire festival for it. And I live like 4 hours from EDC and Coachella. I mean, right now Coachella's lineup this year is very hip hop and EDM centric. I mean, in the past there were a bunch of rock bands on it, and now it's, I think, totally catering to that audience.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. But yeah, I mean, that's, I think SFX really, it kind of almost ruined everything in the electronic sphere, because it started overpaying all of these DJs as it was kind of in a contest with Live Nation to produce the best festivals. So, you know, getting $500,000, or in some cases $1 million, to play for an hour with your laptop in front of this, front of a room full of, or a stage full of 60,000 people.
That's insane, by the way. That's just, yeah, insane. No,
it's insane.
$1 million. Like, I mean, your hourly rate is like $1 million, and you have to bring a laptop. That's just,
and you won't do it for anything less.
I mean, why would you? I mean, when I moved to LA, I don't know if you're familiar with the store Fred Siegel, but I had never heard of it. And I walked in, I saw this really badass Rolling Stones t-shirt, and there was no price tag on it. So I brought it to the counter. I was like, oh, how much is this? Expecting to pay like $20, $30. And like, oh, this is $890. And I was like, what?
Wow.
It was a Rolling Stones shirt that like you would see at a thrift store. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, you know, someone is going to buy this. I guarantee it, but whether it's a tourist or whether it's someone trying to impress someone. And I went back just to see if it was there, and it was gone like a week later. So some moron did that. But the market dictates what it is. I mean, if you're an artist, like if you're Skrillex, for example, and some festival is offering you like $750,000 to do one show, are you going to turn that down? Or are you going to be like, no, I'm worth less? So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so no, no, that's cool, man. I'll do it. I'll do it for half. No, you're going to take all that money, and it's going to go that way. So you said you worked for a company that in 2016 ended up not existing anymore, going under. Were you working for them at that time?
No, at that point, I had left. I left at the end of 2014, actually. So, you know, I spent 9 months out of school working for this company. And it wasn't really going anywhere. There wasn't really, you know, there, I didn't feel like I had any voice in even in what I was doing. And so I left and tried to find, you know, what, something else that was impactful. You know, because to me, music festivals and producing music festivals are meaningful in the aspect that, you know, you spend 6, 9 months, 12 months, you know, working your ass off for 3 days, right? And at those 3 days, you kind of look out into a sea of people, and you kind of realize that you had something to do with making those people have the best weekend, the best night, whatever it was, of their lives. And so, you know, I kind of looked at that as doing something meaningful.
It is.
Something else.
It's very meaningful. These people, I mean, they, like, for example, with Coachella, again, people buy tickets for that a year out when the lineup's not even announced. So it's like they really, really are prepping for that big weekend, and then they go ham.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and that's the thing, right? So for, to me, it was something that was so meaningful, was to help provide those experiences. And I couldn't, you know, walk away and just go get a job doing marketing for, you know, a food delivery service or something. To me, that wasn't that it wasn't going to change lives. It wasn't even going to really do anything other than help people that already have privileged lives.
You wanted to make a bigger impact. I mean, granted, these festivals are helping people on a grand scale with privileged lives because the tickets are pricey, but, you know, you're really making a more positive difference in their lives. I mean, I still think about the Warped Tours that I went to when I was a teenager, and that really shaped who I am now. So respect, dog.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And so, yeah, I was looking for what was next. I kind of came across a company called called Consensus. And at that time, there wasn't any really information about it. There was a kind of their website was a, just their logo with an info at email address. And the description that someone sent to me was, Consensus is a venture studio. It's a decentralized venture studio building applications primarily on Ethereum.
Can you explain what that means to us low-level idiots?
Not low-level, just you know, I think it's
uninformed.
Yes, uninformed would be kind of the best word.
Okay,
because you know this is not an easy space to understand.
But my Facebook feed is completely saturated with experts. Anyway.
Oh yes, of course. You know, just like there were experts back in every age of, you know, this is the best rock band and this is the best DJ. And now everyone's onto cryptocurrency.
Yes, they are. Poison the Well is the next Nirvana. You just wait. No disrespect to Poison the Well, but they weren't. Anyway.
So to be honest, I didn't really even know what it meant. You know, I saw the word Ethereum and I was like, huh. I think that's a cryptocurrency, and I think I might have bought some of that, but I don't even really remember what it is. But, you know, this is the kind of field, this is the work I want to go into, and so I reached out, and weirdly enough, they were actually doing kind of a project at Mysteryland, which was one of the festivals that I used to work on producing. So it was this very kind of ironic, synergetic kind of, I guess...
Coincidence.
Yeah. Coincidence, really.
Yeah.
And so what I learned that that meant was that Consensus was a company that basically was taking blockchain technology. And blockchain is the technology behind all these cryptocurrencies. It's kind of what powers them and what gives them their edge, essentially. And so it's a company that uses blockchain technology within many different projects. So that's kind of the venture studio. So they have all of these different projects kind of working synergetically throughout the company, and the goal of them being that they can spin off and become their own company eventually. And the decentralized applications on Ethereum, decentralized meaning that there is no single entity in charge of these applications. There's no Facebook or Google or Microsoft that controls all the software. And Ethereum is, so if you know what Bitcoin is,
yes,
Bitcoin. Okay. So Bitcoin, digital money, right? That's in a nutshell, that's what Bitcoin is, right? Ethereum kind of takes that to the next level. Basically the concept of doing programmable money and being able to say, you know, if I play this gig, you know, pay me $10. If I don't, you know, I don't get any money, right?
Right.
And so by being able to have that type of contract, but now putting that into a system that's kind of managed by computers instead of people, is kind of, you know, what Ethereum is, right? It's these applications that can run on systems that are decentralized, meaning that there's no single person in control of Ethereum. There's no, you know, one company that writes all the software. It's kind of a community effort that everyone kind of has, you know, it was written by a team of 8 people originally, and now it has become this kind of global software where, you know, you or I could start contributing to the network by just running some software on our computer. And so there's no basically overlord that can say, you know, that's not right, this isn't working, you know, changing, you know, basically there's no MySpace at the top that says, you know, all of a sudden you can't edit your profile anymore.
Right, everyone has their own control and power, and everyone's equal to some extent.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, on that note, though, let's take a short break and listen to whatever beautiful ads Adobe is playing, and listen to whatever song samples Adobe is playing. And I'm just honored that you're the first person in this space to be on the show, and you're also the first person from the 11561 to be on this show. So, respect. Let's take a short break. Hello, we are back with Mr. Jesse Grushak, and he's going to continue to enlighten all of you crazy kids about Ethereum, blockchain, and then eventually Ujo. And I have a t-shirt that has Ujo on it, so I win.
Yes. So Ethereum is this, essentially, you could think of it as kind of a framework to run applications on. And those applications could be anything, right? They could be anything from financial applications, they could be energy applications. You know, basically the premise of just being able to move around assets, and without having to go through a central clearinghouse. And so when Consensus started, so Consensus actually started at the end of 2014, and I came on board in 2015, early 2015. And at that time, it was, you know, 25 of people that are way smarter than I am. And just thinking about, you know, where this technology makes an impact. You know, so we were thinking about energy and finance and accounting, and all of these different applications, and thinking about, you know, how blockchain can help to remove the middlemen. So, you know, you use middlemen in transactions to kind of act as the person, as a clearinghouse, right? So as a person to kind of confirm the transaction and make sure that the two parties agree. And so that, you know, that third party could be anything like a PayPal. So where, you know, you send me goods and I send you money, and PayPal then does the transaction because that gives us a guarantee that the transaction happened.
Like a Venmo type thing?
Venmo too, right? Venmo is a third party at the end of the day. They, you know, you can you use that because most people can't take credit cards, right? And that's the only way you can pay over the internet, really, at least before cryptocurrency.
Or
So, you
dividing a
know,
meal with like 8 people, which is so much
right.
fun at a restaurant.
All of these things act as kind of third parties, and you know, Venmo doesn't take a cut, but they do make their money elsewhere, just by holding your money kind of in their service. And you know, all of these companies, you know, Western Union, for example, right? If you go to send money, they take an 11% fee.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, right? And that's a huge amount. And you know, going into music, publishers, performance rights organizations, labels, all of these people really stand, I wouldn't say they do, they stand in the way of basically your fans and getting your fans money to you. Not that they don't provide other services and other, you know, value, but they do act as middlemen in these situations.
I mean, a lot of
So,
labels are pretty much just banks.
right. And they're banks that take a huge percentage. They're banks that sign you into contracts and make sometimes that are even, you know, like indentured servitude.
It's true.
You know, and so we started looking at this in music and saying, you know what, like the music industry, there's some laws in there, such as like mechanical royalty laws, that are 100 years old. They're, you know, mechanical royalties were invented when player pianos were around because the government didn't want a single company to have a monopoly over player pianos, player piano rolls. So we're using those same basically frameworks
Archaic,
of, yeah,
archaic.
it's archaic, right? It's archaic frameworks that we're still using today. And, you know, I would love for someone to tell me how an MP3 resembles a player piano roll at all, other than, you know, they both are music formats, right?
I don't think I could do that.
most people can't. Because they're not the same at all. You know, they're not, they don't have the same production. They don't have, there's really nothing that is in relational other than they are both music formats. So we were looking at this stuff. We were looking at, you know, the system seems so broken. You know, artists takes anywhere from 3 months to 2 years to get artists paid for what they do. The artists aren't even clued into half the deals that are going on. And we just were like, you know, this is really broken, and we can use blockchain to fix that. And so we put out a thought piece in 2015 to kind of said, you know, here's what we see as the issues. Is there anyone else in the world thinking about this? And luckily, Imogen Heap, the Grammy award-winning UK artist, she's done the song Hide and Seek and scored the new Harry Potter play and has done, you know, tons of other things in music. She reached out to us and she's like, you know, I've had all these crazy ideas for years. You know, I want the ability that if some DJ in Berlin plays my song, you know, I get a notification on my phone and I can call him up later and thank him for playing my music, you know? And we were like, well, that's a little crazy. But we could do something, you know, to help fix these issues or at least start getting on the right path. So really, she gave us a use case. And what we did with her was...
Wait, what's a use case?
Like a use case for the technology, right? So, you know, we have blockchain as this, you know, a lot of people see it as like a magic wand in a lot of ways. But really, you know, you need something to do with it. So she was like, all right, let's test this out by selling my song through essentially the blockchain. And so we built a store. She gave us one of her songs. And she owned that song fully outright. She had all the rights and everything to do whatever she wanted with it. And she gave us that song and said, you know, sell it on the blockchain and I'll give you three different types of licenses that you can sell. So we were selling a streaming license, a download license, and a stems license, which gave you the pieces of the song, which then you could, you know, remix and do whatever you wanted with. As long as you kind of kept, if you went out and sold that song, you would have to pay back 50% of the royalties to Imogen. So you would pick one of these licenses, you would send digital currency, or Ether in this example, to the essentially the what's called a smart contract. And that's like a little chunk of code that holds all the information. So this was holding all the information about the licenses and the songs. So you would send whatever amount of money you wanted to that song, that smart contract. So prices were like 1 cent for a stream, 60 cents for a download, and I think $45 for all the stems.
The stems so you can make your own remixes or...
Right.
Okay.
The individual tracks for, you know, the drums, the piano, the melody. So you would basically send your money to the song. The song would know which license you were purchasing. It would send you back the license and basically like a digital version of the license saying, you know, you purchased this and... here's the policies behind it. And it would send you back the files. So either give you access to a stream or send you the MP3 or send you the stems. And the money would go into the song and the song would then instantly split up the money to all the collaborators. So in 15 seconds, you had the song and a license to own that song. And everyone involved in that song, the drummer, the composer, the violinists, you know, whoever else was involved, her two-year-old baby playing the rattle.
Which is very, very, very useful, just so you know.
Right. But in 15 seconds, everyone in that involved was paid. Everyone.
Seems like a so, good you know, idea.
Right. And that was, you know, how we kind of tossed it out there. It was like, you know, this is possible now. It's possible that we can all get, everyone in the industry can get paid in 15 seconds if we all kind of went down this path and started, you know, building our systems using this technology. Unfortunately for us, or maybe fortunately, you know, it's still a little early to tell. The industry was like, well, that's a really naive way of looking at everything. You know, we don't want to do that.
Why do you think? Because it's difficult or because they wanted more pots and pans?
Well, because a lot of the opaqueness, you know, the non-transparency in the industry is how a lot of these companies make money. You know, we were sitting in the office of a performing rights organization, and they were telling us that an international performing rights organization has 2 years to pay them the royalties from anything outside of the country. And in those 2 years, they would basically trade currency, like pounds and dollars, to make more money on the money before they had to pay it. So, you know, we were sitting there and we couldn't even believe what we were hearing. You know, we would go into a publisher and they would say, yeah, you know, we don't really care. Yeah, we get checks every day, you know, $20, $50, $100. And we don't know who the money's for. We don't know where it's supposed to go. And to figure that out would cost us way more than that. So what we do is, you know, we put it into a bank account, and if someone requests it, we pay it out. But if no one requests it and no one does an audit on their royalties, then we keep it.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, you know? So we were sitting there and we were just like, holy shit,
Yep.
this is fucked up. And not only is it fucked up, that none of these companies really want to use this technology because it would, you know, in their opinion, it would cut out some of the ways they make money.
Potentially a lot of them.
Right, you know, and you know, in a perfect world, our idea was that, you know, if we could take the music industry, lift it up, scrape out 100 years of bullshit, put in, you know, a framework for the 21st century that allows music, money, data to flow around as open as it does on the internet, drop the music industry back down, probably 75% of the people would land back on their feet in some aspects. You know, they might have to change their business models, they might have to do a couple different things, but you know, there still is a lot of value provided by the industry. You know, managers, you know, yourself included, you guys do a lot for these artists, but
Don't get me
you also do
started. Don't get me started.
a no. You also do a lot of bullshit, right? A lot of paperwork, a lot of, you know, shit that is just tedious and really doesn't result in totally improving the lives of these artists.
And we don't bill for everything. We get a contingency. So for every phone call, like for example, if I was speaking with this guy named Jesse at Ujo about a band for an hour. I mean, that might not go anywhere, and I don't bill my artist for it. I just get a percentage of what they earn. So there's just so many hours in the day that doesn't result in quote unquote tangible success. But anyway, back to you.
No, I mean that's an important, it's an important kind of, you know, point on this whole system is that there is so much that goes into building an artist that can't be done automatically. But what we can do with this technology is really automate a lot of the business administration that goes into the music industry. So that's royalties, that's accounting, that's you know, direct payments to artists. A lot of this stuff that takes hours and hours and has, you know, armies of interns at these giant labels to do, we could do that automatically. And what that kind of results in is more time focused on actually building the artist's career, more time focused on the music, on the art, on the creativity. And so, you know, we kind of said to ourselves, why are we talking to all these people? They're never going to want to do anything. You know, it's kind of like slamming your head into a brick wall until one of them breaks.
Wow.
You know, I mean, seriously, it's like, you know, I think there's a quote from a former Warner exec that it was like, historically, the music industry has finished in adopting new technologies. The music industry places second in front of the Amish.
Oh my God, that's some progressive shit.
Right, so it's such an uphill battle to try to get these companies to adopt technology that, and without, you know, saying, you know, going, being able to walk in and being like, you know what, we're going to increase your bottom line by 100%, and we're also going to increase the artist line by 150%, without being able to say that, because, you know, we're kind of playing in a new sphere here. They don't care. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to spend time working on it. And unless they realize that they're immediately in danger, you know, they're not trying to change. And that's kind of exactly what happened with Napster in 2000.
I was just going to say that they had no idea. They had the opportunity to, when MP3s and I guess storing music digitally in the form of like a 5 megabyte file, they had the chance to monetize that, and they're just like, nah. And then
Right.
boom.
Exactly. You know, and I think, you know, a lot of them harp on, you know, well, piracy is the biggest problem in the industry. And it's like, no, it's not. It was a problem for a couple of years, but it was only a problem because there was no way to get music digitally, right? You know, you probably remember better than I do, even than when iTunes came out.
You calling
And
me
the
old?
only way to,
Sorry.
I am calling you a little older than I am.
It's true.
But you know, basically, when iTunes came out, there was no way to get music on your iTunes.
Nope.
You could sit there and you could, you know, I remember your room used to have hundreds of CDs in your room in Long Beach.
Damn fucking right.
How long do you think it would have taken you to put every single one of those CDs in iTunes?
It's honestly, it took, I'd say, like 5 to 10 minutes per CD, and I'm just letting you know that I'll never have that time back.
Right, exactly. And sitting there, you know, 5 to 10 minutes per CD, and you can't get up and do anything because if you miss when it's done, you got to go take it out. So, you know, what was easier? To go onto Napster and just click
Yep,
download.
download a Metallica song, dog.
Exactly, you know? And it wasn't that you wanted to steal the music because you bought most of it. It was just that it was so much fucking easier to click download.
Yep, it's right in front of you. It's a digital jukebox.
Right. And so, you know, that was kind of why piracy took off, was because it was the access. It wasn't even that people wanted to steal. It was just easier to access music digitally than it was to access it by uploading every single one of your CDs.
And obviously saving money while doing that. We don't have too much time left, so I'd like you to go into as much as you can about Ujo, if possible.
Cool. Yeah.
The
So
meat and
basically,
potatoes of this whole
in a
thing.
nutshell, of what we were doing, you know, basically, we started looking at the existing industry and we realized this sucks. We're not going to get anywhere. We have to really, you have to start from scratch if you want to build everything in a better way. So we started looking at, you know, what it really makes, what is the music industry composed of, right? It's composed of musicians, it's composed of artists first, and that is what powers the whole thing. And then, you know, what is an artist at its core? You know, besides like digitally, what is an artist, right? And that's their identity and their content. And so now being able to control and own that identity and attaching content and being able to control and own that content attached to your identity, that's how we can start to make the system fluid. So we started building a portal essentially, which is going to allow artists to go on to register their content, to register themselves in a format that then we can use to move around the web. So we have the portal right now. What you're able to do is you're able to go on, you're able to register yourself and your music, and set kind of one licensing policy right now. And that licensing policy is to sell it, put it into a store. So essentially it's Bandcamp in a kind of harder to use version, which isn't that sexy right now, but the future vision of this is that, you know, how do we create an open music industry where developers, where, you know, creators and innovators can build off of what exists rather than having to start over each time? Can license catalogs with a couple clicks rather than having, like, Spotify having to spend $250 million to license their catalog to get their company off the ground.
And there's some lawsuits now too, so that's fun.
Exactly. Right. Because, you know, all these artists say, yeah, do whatever you want with my music. Or they don't even say that. They say, give me an advance. And the company says, all right, well, I'm going to do whatever I want with your music. And that kind of perpetuates this broken industry. So really kind of we're looking at is how do we create an adjacent industry right now that gives artists choice, that gives artists the choice to say, you know, yeah, I can take an advance or I can try something new. I can try to put my music into a way where I can interact directly with fans. I can sell music directly to fans without going through all of these systems. You know, and there are going to have to be bridges built along the way. And, you know, we're planning on doing that, but we're also planning on basically making the portal open source so that other people can do it too. So that it's not just us kind of rebuilding this industry, but it's anyone with developing skills that can, you know, create the next Spotify or the next SoundCloud. And you know, we think that this collaboration like model will really help build a better industry that puts the artist at the top, you know, because it shouldn't be that if you're not happy with your record deal, if you're not happy with your manager, you have to spend years in a lawsuit to change that. You know, you should just be able to pull the plug immediately and walk away with everything that you've done, with all the content you've created, and really, you know, you paid the bills. Good. The relationship's over. You know, instead of right now, where like we were talking about earlier, that the artists are these kind of indentured servants to the system.
Well, I hope you fix the frickin' system, man.
Trying. We're trying.
Well, I guess, speaking of which, Thank you very much for fixing this show system and being our first blockchain, cryptocurrency, even electronic expert on this show. And I guess if you wouldn't mind giving any website details or ways to learn more about Ujo or anything in general, this is your shout out corner.
Cool. Yeah. You can follow us on Twitter at Ujo Music. That's probably where we'll be posting updates. We're kind of working on the beta right now, which will be available at ujomusic.com, and that should be out in the next month or so. And yeah, you know, at the end of the day, we just want to see more art and more creativity and help, you know, I guess all your listeners really achieve their dreams and achieve their dreams so that not everyone is a starving artist anymore.
Well, I appreciate that. And speaking of starving artists, it's not lunchtime for you, but it's about lunchtime for me. So I think I need to grab some food. So every single Tuesday at 5 o'clock Pacific time, which is my time zone, and 8 o'clock Eastern time, which is Jesse's time zone in the unhip sector of Brooklyn. And every single Sunday morning at 5 o'clock AM, my time, 8 o'clock AM, Jesse's time. And you can go on iTunes, you can go on idobe.com, listen, download, and just rock out to Walden's words. So, Jesse, thanks again for doing the show, and we will talk soon.